for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. My name is Anna.
And I'm Sam.
And Sam, I know we have an extremely beautiful and intricate and mysterious and force-laden episode to talk about this week. But first, we're going to talk about Star Wars Does Enemies to Lovers.
Okay.
I cannot contain my glee!
So tell us about The Honorable Ones.
Okay, yeah. So we're recapping The Honorable Ones and Shroud of Darkness this week. It is Rebels Season 2, Episodes 17 and 18. And in The Honorable Ones, we take the characters with the two deepest registers on the entire show and put them in an ice cave together. And it is gravel and tension and vulnerability and love.
I feel like you might have watched a different episode than I have, but
absolutely not.
Tell us all about the
I will tell
ones.
You all about it, and then after the plot recap I will give you proof from the captain of the ship himself.
Wait, where'd you get that bulletin board? What are you doing?
It's all true, Your Honor. So, The Honorable Ones is deeply heartwarming. It also skims straight over a potential genocide. So, we do have more to talk about than one of my favorite tropes. But, in this episode, the Spectres walk straight into a trap.
They're on an orbiting station above Geonosis. They recognize that there's no life on Geonosis that they can perceive. And so they board this abandoned station, but a little cackling R2 unit seals them in. It is a trap.
And then the doors sneak open and there are stormtroopers everywhere. Agent Callus has once again baited and set the trap and they fall for it. However, the Spectres all make it out except for Zeb, who gets locked in a little room fighting Callus hand to hand. It is just the beginning of the romantic tension. Zeb tells the Spectres not to wait. He yeets into an escape pod. Callus follows him into the pod, and then they get shot down to one of Geonosis's moons.
Because they're wrestling in there, and they're banging up against the emergency go-the-wrong-direction lever and hit it.
Wrestling. So this is an ice moon, conveniently. It is nothing like Geonosis. Callus and Zeb end up landing in a cave. Callus's leg is injured, so Zeb bodily throws him out of the pod onto the ground and then proceeds to fend off dinosaurs for him. He bandages his leg with a bow rifle. He finds him not one but two heating sources. One of them is a meteorite, a.k.a. a shiny rock.
It's just a big old hunk of uranium.
What you give to someone when you tell them you want to be with them.
Oh my God.
Forever. There is some very emotional bonding. One thing that really changes Zeb's mind about Callus is when he tells Zeb about how he got his bow rifle.
Yeah, because in, I think it's season one, episode one, Callus calls out and says, Lasat, I killed all of your people and took this bow rifle. And he reveals a change.
That's not how it happened. He was on Onderon, presumably around the time that Ahsoka was also on Onderon.
Yeah, or the Bad Batch.
And Callus was in charge of a group of Imperial soldiers fighting against the insurgents led by Steela and then Saw Gerrera. A Lasat mercenary came after Callus's crew and killed them all, but left Callus for dead. And then on Lasan, when Callus was leading the Imperial takedown of the planet, the Lasat guard that he was fighting recognized that he was beaten and in a Lasat ritual offered his bow rifle to Callus because Callus was the superior warrior.
Kallus also remarks that things got out of hand on Lassan and it wasn't supposed to be a massacre, but someone needed to be made an example of.
Mm-hmm. So they have these interesting bonding scenes. However, they are then chased by space pterodactyls and have to defend each other and get out of the ice cave. So, you know, there's a delightful scene where Kallus is piggybacking on Zeb and Zeb is clambering up stalactites and has to yeet him out into the snow. They make it out. They fix the transponder and they fall asleep spooning each other.
Leaning up against each other.
Waiting for someone to pick up the signal.
Because although the original transponder was set for the Imperial frequency, Zeb was able to set it to be to whom it may concern. And so the whole time it's a guess of who's going to show up and who's going to be arrested.
So the Spectres show up for Zeb, mm-hmm. and Zeb and Kallus sort of bow to each other. And Zeb is like, do you want to come with us? We'll treat you fairly. And Kallus is like, no, I'm going to wait for the Empire to pick me up. So Kallus is listening as Zeb gets this beautiful, warm welcome from his family. They were so worried about him. They never stopped searching for him. And the final scene of the episode is Kallus limping back to his quarters on one of the Imperial ships. Mm-hmm. And no one is excited to see him. And he goes back and sits alone
in his absolutely bare room, which is like basically a prison cell. It's
in his
miserable,
terrible room on his terrible, lonely bed. And he puts the meteorite that Zeb found for him on a shelf and just sits there.
Yeah.
And that, Sam, is a tragedy.
It is.
Justice for these babies. We didn't even get a kiss.
So that's the honorable ones.
That's what I'll say about the honorable ones so far. Please tell me what happened in, I guess, the strategically far more important episode, Shroud of Darkness.
Well, maybe. So Shroud of Darkness, we just begin in media lightsaber in the middle of a fight between the two current Inquisitors, Fifth Brother and Seventh Sister, versus Kanan and Ezra. It's like apparently they're on this planet made out of thunder and rocks and they're fighting back and forth and we're seeing lots of cool moves. Eventually, Ezra and Kanan escape on the back of a space air manta whale, which is great.
Kanan is like, you did this? And he's like bewildered and flabbergasted and so proud.
Yeah. So they're still on the we're looking for a base plot. And there's an interesting aside that Kanan definitely feels like this is a separate thing. Like the Kanan and Ezra show is a spinoff from the Spectre Cell and Phoenix Cell show. So he's very much clear about that. But he calls up Hera and says, hey, we're interrupting Jedi training month to ask for Ahsoka. So they meet up with Ahsoka and they all get together and fly off. Sabine and Hera are like, we don't know where they're going and it's better not to know because this is a force users expedition.
Yeah, so Kanan is concerned that the Inquisitors can sense them everywhere they go. It's mm-hmm. really endangering the rest of the Rebel Cell. And Ahsoka is like, normally we would ask Obi-Wan or Yoda what to do. Too bad they're not around. And Kanan and Ezra look at each other and they're like, we actually have a hotline to Yoda.
Yeah.
Lego.
So they go to the Jedi Temple on Lothal, and it is now winter, so there's a little scattering of snow everywhere. And they stand there and they're ready to lift up the temple, and Ahsoka is like, I better not do this because I am not a Jedi, and this is for Jedi only standing in this circle. So Ezra and Kanan lift up the temple. And then they keep lifting, and there's an additional layer further down, a new door for them to enter. New door, new problems. So they all enter and figure out what to do. So they begin meditating separately. Immediately, Kanan finds a door in the wall and just disappears into it. And then while Ahsoka is expositing, because earlier Ezra had walked in and watched Ahsoka watching a holocron of Anakin fighting, and they had a beautiful moment about Anakin. And so Ahsoka is telling Ezra about Anakin, and as she closes her eyes to remember him, Ezra disappears. And then we begin the three separate journeys of our Force users. Kanan has entered a dojo and is fighting one of the Jedi Temple Guardians, and he is told, if you fight, you will die, your rebellion will die, your apprentice will turn to the dark side, and all that you've ever fought for will be lost. And he's like, well, that's BS. So he starts fighting. And then he's fighting three temple guardians, and he's getting his butt whooped. He picks up another lightsaber off the wall. This one's red. He's fighting back and forth. And eventually he sits down and he says, you're right. I have learned that no matter how much I try to protect him, all I can do is actually lead Ezra to his goal, to make him stronger. And that is my only duty. We'll pause there because things are happening concurrently. Ezra, going along, is in space. He's just sitting on a little platform of existence in the wider galaxy in space. And sitting on another little moss-covered wood platform is Yoda. And Yoda and Ezra have a wonderful conversation. Yoda is definitely thinking about how, as soon as the Jedi began fighting the Clone Wars, they lost it. Because of course the Jedi are going to win. What matters is how they win. And as soon as they started fighting, they had already given in and there was no longer Jedi.
Yeah, the action of deciding to fight was their corruption. It turned them to the dark side mm-hmm. without even realizing it. But Ezra is insistent. He's like, no, we've decided we're fighting this fight.
Mm-hmm. And so Yoda says, go to Malachor. Meanwhile, Ahsoka is sitting there. She is not teleported to a different dimension within the Jedi Temple, but behind her, she's being berated by Anakin, saying, why weren't you there for me? Don't you know what happened? Do you know what I've become? Cut to Anakin being Darth Vader.
And Ahsoka screams.
While everyone has reached their realizations, Chopper, parked out front, has taken the car and hidden elsewhere because the Inquisitors have shown up and are lifting the temple bodily out of the ground. Instead of beautiful blue ring crop circles around the temple, it's red. Things are going pretty bad. The Inquisitors are showing up and all these visions are interrupted because it is time to go. The temple guard takes off his mask, reveals that it is the Grand Inquisitor. Ooh. This is who he was before he became the Grand Inquisitor, and he formally knights Kanan.
Stop. There were tears rolling down my cheeks.
And then he says, your enemies have arrived. Go. We will defend you as long as possible. And so as our heroes are escaping the temple, the Inquisitors walk in and are surrounded by a bunch of Jedi Temple Guardians, including the one who became the Grand Inquisitor.
Their former boss.
And then fade to lightsaber battle. It's not looking good for them. The good guys escape, and they all talk about what they need to do and where they're going. But then we cut to, now the Jedi Temple has been lifted out. It's full of stormtroopers. There's a bunch of scientific equipment around. And Darth Vader strolls in jovially because my master will be very pleased at what you've found here. Great job, minions. And the Inquisitors are like, the Jedi are growing in power. And Vader says, that will be their undoing.
Woo-hoo-hoo!
So that is Shroud of Darkness.
Two beefy episodes.
Yeah. Honorable Ones is great because it draws on a lot of 80s movies tropes.
Really?
Yeah, well, there's one called Enemy Mine, which is very famous as sort of a B-minus, C-plus movie from the 80s about a human and an alien, like, starfighter pilot who crash land on the same planet and have to, like, protect each other.
Mm.
Yeah, and the alien pilot, through parthenogenesis, becomes pregnant, and then the human pilot has to raise the child as his own, which
What's
is funny.
Parthenogenesis?
Self-reproduction.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's a way of fading to black that I've never seen before. But so do you want to start with the honorable ones, or do you want to start with Shroud of Darkness?
I think we should start with the honorable ones. We'll get back on track. Unless you are going to take up the whole hour with the honorable ones.
I could. I definitely could. I'm interested that you read this so differently than me.
So the way I read this is they are both warriors. And we had two key moments. One of them is that Kallus is continuously surprised by how Zeb doesn't just kill him.
Right. And we get the reasoning for that. So I think it's interesting that this episode is presenting a standalone Imperial figure who up until this point has been ruthless and driven and almost one-dimensional, cackling, maniacal in his evil, and gives us the backstory as to why he assumes that Zeb will kill him as soon as he gets the chance.
Because the last time he faced, well, the first time he went into battle, his entire crew was killed by Al-Asad. Mm-hmm. And so he has, so Kallus is surprised that Zeb has like a warmness to him, that Zeb is like, not all Lasat are ruthless murderers. I was the high honor guard. Like, I am an honorable person.
I'm an honorable one.
Yeah. Like, when he takes Kallus out and flings him to the floor, he's like, I'm not going to kill you while you have a broken leg. Like,
I'm going to let you heal up and then kill you then.
Yeah. Which is, you know, a form of honor, which is interesting. And then Zeb also recognizes during this whole scene that he's like, I'm not actually the brains of this operation. I'm very rarely the brains of any operation that I am in. And when they're escaping, he's trying to climb the walls. And Kallus is like, you can't climb the walls. You have to climb the pillars to get out of here, because they're the ones that are load-bearing and it's closer to the edge. So Kallus is really critical for keeping them alive. But I don't think Zeb would be willing to kill him in cold blood either.
No, definitely not. It's interesting that they get to have a fluid equality between them, because Zeb is the one who is mobile. So mm-hmm. He is the one who can shoulder the bow rifle and defend them from the snow pterodactyls. He finds the meteorite that keeps them alive.
Mm-hmm. But then when the first monster shows up, it shoves Zeb inside the escape pod. And Zeb is sitting there and he's like trying to not get eaten and keep himself together. And Kallus has to hobble over and shoot it with his bow rifle. Mm-hmm. So this whole time, the first half of it, they're always glancing at who has what guns where.
Uh-huh.
And then by the second, and that continues, Zeb tries to make this easier. He uses Kallus's bow rifle as a splint for Kallus's leg, and then he flings his own bow rifle and the transponder and the heating rock up over the lip of the rock and saying, well, we either succeed or we die here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the actual escape moment itself is truly hilarious, because they're climbing up and they're being attacked by schmonsters, and Zeb... Kallus falls off, Zeb grabs him with one of his feet, and then Zeb, he uses one of his toes to turn on the spike end of the bow rifle, and then he alley-oops Kallus to stab the tip of the bow rifle that's pointing out of Kallus's foot into the ceiling. So Kallus is hanging there.
Like a pinata.
Upside down by his splint, screaming. He's like, no, 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 no. And then Zeb rodeo clowns on top of the schmonsters. Kallus falls. Zeb catches him. And then Zeb jumps out. Zeb is struggling. Kallus appears at the top of the lip with Zeb's bow rifle pointed right at him. But Kallus shoots the schmonster.
Right. So he also proves himself to be one of the honorable Imperials.
And I think part of this is showing that, like, Kallus is not a cackling, maniacally evil person. He is indoctrinated. Mm-hmm. He is propagandized to believe that the rebels are all insane. And that's because his first interaction with rebels was Saw Gerrera. But he's gone through this whole time, and now that he's met with Zeb, he recognizes that in him is a fellow warrior. And I think that's why Kallus spends so much time talking about how, like, he is doing things rationally. He doesn't revel in killing the Lasat. He says he did it because he wanted to win that fight with Zeb, because he got into a fight with an 8-foot-tall purple people eater. And it's like, geez, like, what am I going to do? I need to do some intimidation damage first. So when he's honest about his motives, it changes. But also, in the Lyra San episode, Zeb has let go. Like, Zeb says that the worrying about the genocide of the Lasat people is no longer the most important thing for me.
Because he knows that it wasn't a total genocide. He knows that there are Lasat living happily on Lirasan.
That one of the colonies of the Lasat was destroyed, but not the homeworld of the Lasat, which is a pretty significant distinction.
Yeah, this episode would have been extremely different if it had taken place before Legends of the Lasat.
Yes.
But because this episode takes place after a significant moment for Zeb's character growth, it can be different.
Yeah. I also did not pick up any sexual tension between them whatsoever, but that's just me.
Fascinating. So I think you are reading this in the way that Dave Filoni intended.
Probably.
And I'm going to tell you about an interaction that happened at one of the Star Wars conventions to sort of illustrate the two different thought processes on this.
Okay.
So Dave Filoni and Steve Bloom, Steve Bloom is the voice actor for Zeb, were at a Star Wars convention. And Steve Bloom is like, I am so glad that Dave Filoni gave us this queer interracial couple. I love Hot Callus. I love that he is Zeb's husband. They're gonna go off to Lirasan and live together happily forever and have so many children. And Dave Filoni is like, no, Steve, it's about forgiveness. And Steve Bloom is like, okay.
If you say so.
If you say so. But Steve Bloom is like, no, they end up on Lirasan. Callus becomes a gardener and Zeb becomes a handyman. They raise many children and they love each other forever. And so, like, I didn't even need that context when I watched the episode. I was like, no, there's only one heat cube, which is basically there's only one bed. There are piggyback rides. Zeb is bandaging Callus's wounds. There is spooning. They cuddle until dawn. I don't know what else you need.
I think that there exists very little space in modern Western culture for male physical intimacy that is not sexual. And there exists the need for all people to have some level of like physical intimacy that is like we are staying together for warmth. It's a very primal thing to be next to someone because it's cold. It's a very primal thing to be next to be like, we both have to survive this because I can't live with myself if I get out of this without saving you. And so I read it straight.
Okay. So you watched Lord of the Rings and you're like, oh, okay, so Sam and Frodo were just best friends.
I think there's space for that.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a need for them to have like a physical relationship for them to love each other as friends.
Yes.
And I think that there is room, perhaps in the future, because it feels like out of all the moments in Callus' life, this was a truly transformative one. This rock from Zeb is the very first thing that is not Imperial issue in his quarters.
Yes. I do not in any way want to invalidate the take. I think no matter what, the story of a diehard Imperial and a diehard Rebel finding common ground is really, really important. I think it's an important story for us in 2024, as important as it probably was in 2016. Now that we're seeing 2024 shape up to be remarkably similar to 2016 politically, this is a very, this is a significant storyline and we should not in any way discount it or invalidate it. My last receipt is that I did plot out their relationship using the six steps that it takes to turn enemies into lovers.
According to whom?
According to some reputable internet sources that I forgot to cite. I should have known you would ask me that.
I'm just wondering who has these steps and what do they use them for?
Literally, all we were missing was step six, which is like a meaningful hand touch or a kiss or a fade to black. Sam, did you know Calizeb is the second most popular ship under the Rebels tag on AO3?
I would believe that.
I mean, the tags are so good. Mutual pining, idiots in love, idiots. Alexander Callus is bad at feelings. This is a whole ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. I think that it is a very neat story. I think more than enemies to lovers, it might be enemies to erstwhile allies.
Mm, and it might be fire-forged friends.
Yeah, and it might be humanizing. Another way to look at this is the Christmas armistice during World War I, when all of the soldiers on both sides got up to play soccer on Christmas.
That is beautiful.
And then their commanding officers started shelling them, their own men, because they didn't want the people to recognize that they were fighting against, like, ideologies. Oh. And you know what? That actually aligns with the things that they were saying. Zeb is saying, what about all the people, like, what happened on Geonosis? Why did you kill all the people on Geonosis? And Kallus is like, I have no idea what you're talking about, and there's no reason why the Empire would do that. Mm-hmm. Like, why would they? And Zeb is like, when you start asking those kind of questions, you start finding really interesting answers. Mm-hmm. And that is also a moment of radicalization, because that is where Zeb is able to he's actually able to be the mental mentor in that relationship.
Right. So one of my burning questions for the honorable ones before we transition into our discussion of Shroud of Darkness is that Kallus becomes a more sympathetic character to us this episode. We get a lot of reasons for the way he is. We get a lot of reasons for why his brain works the way it does. Mm-hmm. Zeb is able to begin, plant the seeds of a radicalization process. Mm-hmm. Do you think Kallus is meant to be one of the characters this season who's converted to the rebellion after being exposed to the Spectres? That's what this whole season has been about.
This is what this whole season has been about. It's fun to see. Rex makes a short appearance in this one. He's just riding the guns of the Ghost.
And he's like, yep, Geonosians.
Yeah, I shot up this planet so many times, you guys. And so as we've moved along through the season, it feels like we started with Rex. And Rex is like, I claim my bunk on the Ghost.
Yeah.
And then we moved on and we got people who were like rebel curious. And then we got people who were like, I will fight for, I'll cover for you. You know, that's the protector of Concord Dawn.
Right. The Mandalorian.
Fenrau. Fenrau is like, I will cover for you.
Ryder Azadi is like, I was glancingly an accidental rebel. I think I'm going full flag.
Yeah, I got the taste for killing again. And then we get to, yeah, and so Fenrau and Kallus are at the other end of the spectrum where they're like, and Katsuyonio, who are like, maybe I will think on it. Mm-hmm. Like, at the very least, I now see that there is something, a larger world that I can take a step into.
You think that's where Kallus lands?
It seems like.
That is pretty significant for a relatively high-ranking Imperial officer.
Yeah, as an ISB agent, we've seen in the past, he commands forces. He is functionally an admiral in terms of the resources he is able to bring to bear on things.
Yeah, he feels like pretty much an equal with Admiral Constantine.
Well, that doesn't say nice things about Kallus, because Admiral Constantine is a doofus. But in terms of job title, yes.
The piece of trivia that I read about the final scene of The Honorable Ones is that if they had time in the script, they were going to flesh out that interaction between Kallus and Constantine. Mm. Kallus comes limping onto the ship, and the first person he sees is Constantine, and he's like, Admiral. And Constantine won't even look him in the eye. Mm-hmm. And the script, before it was cut for time, read that the Empire basically reached their time limit on the amount of minutes they spend looking for a lost officer.
Yeah.
Called off the search for him. Kallus was found by an independent traitor who read the distress signal, picked him up, dropped him back off to the Imperials. And Constantine didn't even give Kallus the time of day after he returned from the dead.
Wow.
Which is supposed to give us a deeper understanding of how little the Empire cares for the lives of even their high-ranking officers. They're all expendable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which we're supposed to contrast with the beautiful welcome of the Spectres to their returning brother.
It is. It's a very funny scene. Zeb's like, oh, you know, any one of us has been in situations tougher than this. It wasn't so bad. Because he does that sometimes. He gets like overly humble when he's rescued. And then Ezra's like, hey, it's cold. Like, let's go. 2 seconds. 2 seconds too long. Let's go. It's a funny scene. It's a fun episode. And I think it is very impactful.
Are we going to talk about the genocide of billions of Geonosians again?
I mean, spoilers.
I don't want spoilers.
Okay, it's a plot point now.
Okay.
We've planted a seed that apparently there's no Geonosians on Geonosis.
Okay. It was deeply sus to me because no one in Star Wars would talk about the deaths of billions of humans in such a casual way.
Yeah. But also, the Geonosians were on the wrong side of the war with the Separatists. They also, at the ends of episodes 2 and 3, were involved in the creation of the Death Star.
Yeah, no. We know that we don't like the Geonosians, but we also talked at length in the Clone Wars about how Jedi and clones alike murder lots and lots of bugs, and it is not treated like a big deal because they're not humanoid.
Yeah.
And like, Sam, I know you called me a creaturist, a screecherist this week, and like, I know I'm always on the side of the space creatures, but no one would put a plot point that involved billions with a B of humans being casually genocided in Star Wars.
Yeah, that's...
Billions with a B is really different from, like, the slagging of Topoka City, you know?
Yeah, it is. Although the slagging of Topoka City was also the genocide of the Kaminoan people. And we've seen, we just talked about the genocide of the Lasat people on an entire planet.
Okay,
it just turns out that it's not a xenocide killing an entire species.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah.
But, importantly, Kaminoans, Lasat, and Geonosians are not humans.
That's true.
So I'm just pointing out a little bit of lip service over here.
That's true. Well, let's talk a little bit about Shroud of Darkness because it's also kind of an important episode.
Oh my God, it's so good.
This episode is fantastic. There's really fun stuff. There's a lot of little Easter eggs.
Yeah, so much to unpack.
So starting with the initial fight, They've got these great moves. Ezra and Kanan are like, cross, switch. They're calling commands out to each other to switch who they're fighting up with.
Oh my God, it's one of my favorite duels of all time. I love Kanan yeeting Ezra around like a ping pong. I just love it. They're really growing.
They are really growing. They're working well together. There's a funny Easter egg moment where Kanan switches to fighting with the Seven Sister. The Seven Sister says, you'd be very cute. And he's like, I don't go for crazy anymore. So there's two things with that. One is that those two voice actors are married. And the other one is that Kanan, in one of his comic books, dated crazy girls before he met Hera.
Who did he date?
I don't know exactly. I was just looking at like this jives with like his past history because he bummed around on like tramp freighters doing sketchy rogue stuff for a while.
I mean, he was still doing sketchy rogue stuff when we met him, and Hera was actively keeping him more on the straight and narrow.
Exactly.
So that tracks.
But then the understanding, okay, so the next important scene to me is the holocron of Anakin.
Oh, I was going to say quickly that Ezra calling the manta rays to get them out of there almost effortlessly is extremely beautiful, and I do think it points to his growth. But you're right. In the larger plot, probably the Anakin holocron scene is more impactful.
So Ahsoka is watching as Anakin says, I've made some adjustments to the normal Form 4 that are more effective at fighting droids and other ranged enemies. Watch.
Amazing.
And it's like he's teaching a course and he's going through the cadences. And Ezra walks in and he's like, that dude is amazing. I watched this and I've become so much better. And Ahsoka says, he was my master. So I guess they're in Ezra's quarters or something watching this holocron. And Ahsoka says, he was my master. What people don't know about him is how kind he was.
And how he would do anything for his friends to the last.
And then they sit around and they have this problem. And it's as if we got a bunch of Jedi in a room and they're like, what do we do? And Ahsoka says, when I was the Padawan to one of the greatest Jedi generals of all time, and we ran into a problem, we'd talk to a Jedi master. And then they all look around like, there are very few Jedi masters left. And there's such great artistry in Ahsoka's animation, her facial animation, because mm-hmm. when they're like, well, we kind of know how to get in touch with Yoda. And she's like, excuse you? Like, how?
Yeah, it's an important moment because I think it's touching on a really thorny and real problem of young rebellions, mm-hmm. which is that young rebellions can generally only start with the Council of Experts, but wars of attrition mean that you have fewer and fewer experts and veterans as the war goes on.
Yeah.
And at a point, you look around and you're like, we are young people and we're as close to the Jedi Masters as we can probably get. And it's such a lifeline that they can get in touch with Yoda.
And then the information they get from Yoda is bespoke for each of their problems, right? So Kanan learns the lesson he needs to learn, and it's absolutely critical. I love this fight scene because it is obviously the Grand Inquisitor. It's the same animation style. He's got the voice. It's modulated, but you can tell that it is the same fighter. And as they're fighting back and forth, he immediately says, try to fight and you will fail. The rebellion will be destroyed. You will die and your apprentice will become a servant of evil. And then he picks up his lightsaber. And that's like a hell of a way to open a sentence. Like that's a hell of a way to open a conversation. Try to fight. And that is very much the instructions that Kanan needed, but he needed to fight his way through it and learn that his fight as he understands it is unwinnable. And the only fight he can do is to protect himself and to protect Ezra. He must teach Ezra everything he knows, which contrasts deeply with the teachings of the Sith. Because when you're Sith, you aren't trying to protect your apprentice. You're trying to train them to protect you and hold back as much information as you can, just, you know, meeting it out to them in such a way to keep them still hungry. But this Jedi Knight and Padawan relationship is teach them everything you can to keep them alive as long as possible.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. We know from all of our long history of Force episodes, we've got the Mortis arc from the Clone Wars. We've got Yoda's journey.
Yes.
This counts to me as a deeply Force episode. Everything in a Force vision is significant. And I want to talk about how Kanan first tries to fight back before he realizes the inevitability of his situation. Mm-hmm. And he picks up to further guard himself against the Temple Guardians, a red lightsaber.
Yes, that was just on the wall, but yeah.
So do you think that was supposed to symbolize that Kanan would or will attempt to use the dark side to further his goal of protecting Ezra?
I think the lesson he learned was by himself, whether or not he picks up the dark side is still not enough to protect Ezra. So he learned the lesson that Anakin never did, because Anakin was like, I can't protect Padme with the light side of the Force. And Palpatine's like, well, what about the dark side of the Force?
I hadn't even thought about Kanan as a foil to Anakin.
But Kanan is sitting here and he realizes it doesn't matter what I do, I can't protect my Padawan.
Ooh. Yeah, so when we watched the Rebels Recon extra footage for these episodes, there's a very poignant moment where the voice actor Freddie Prinze Jr. for Kanan says, Kanan learned an extremely rare lesson in this episode, which is the importance of not fighting, even when you're capable of it. And Freddie Prinze Jr. was like, very few Jedi ever learned that lesson, which I think is extremely interesting considering the long history of the Jedi. Jedi have been around for thousands of years. I presume a lot of them lived in peacetime.
Yep.
So it's pretty radical to say this is a rare lesson to learn. That's what made Kanan worthy of being knighted.
Yes. We are transitioning from the way Jedi are in the High Republic and Late Republic era into the way they are in the Age of Rebellion. Mm. And in that, each of them has to learn when to throw their lightsaber down and say, I am beaten because, as we talk about in Ezra's vision with Yoda, it doesn't matter that you fight, it matters how you fight.
Mm. How are Jedi supposed to fight?
They're supposed to be peacemakers. You're not supposed to fight even, I think, like to defend yourself or to defend like a critical thing from long-ranging destruction, but that destruction kind of needs to go somewhere. And so you need to get there before the events which precipitate destruction. You need to head off a civil war before it begins, not through assassination, but through diplomacy. You need to get to the root causes of problems and move them. I've been reading the culture series, and I started the second book, Player of Games, and there's a lot of conversation about what the culture, which is this like, I mean, they're kind of an analog of the Jedi, what they do to make sure that no one causes too much trouble around them. And they infiltrate, they go in, they will affect change, and they do it with a subtlety that no one could ever read their fingerprints on anything. And they do that because that is the best way to bring about peace, honestly, is to make sure that no one would ever even think of war.
So that, and maybe I'm reading this from such a Western egocentric angle.
Yes.
I acknowledge my bias here, but if Kanan's lesson is not to fight the inevitable, what if Ezra does fall to the dark side? That is what is being premonitioned.
It is a if-then clause. If you try to fight, then your apprentice will fall to the dark side. If you try to fight to defend your apprentice, as opposed to if you teach your apprentice everything they need to protect themselves. Because if someone is secure in their own self, then they won't try to reach the dark side for their own power.
Okay. Kanan. He understands if-then sentences, which clearly I do not.
Well, he also had the physical object lesson of like, you walk into a room and it says, if you try to fight, I'm going to whoop your butt. And he's like, I'm going to fight. And then his butt gets whooped. He's like, oh, okay, I see.
Okay, fair.
Yeah. It is a, if I try to fight, my butt gets whooped.
So there are other lessons in the temple. Ezra gets clarity on where to go next in the fight. I feel like he also gets validation from Yoda that he's getting stronger.
He gets validation from Yoda that he's getting stronger because he's like, I can see you now. Because right before that, Ezra and Ahsoka are sitting there and Ezra's like, I've never seen Yoda, but Kanan describes him as like this weird little wrinkly green dude with huge ears. And Ahsoka's like, yeah, that's Yoda. But Ezra sees Yoda and Yoda says, oh, that means you're growing stronger. And Yoda is trying to teach him all these lessons of what it means to be a Jedi, but Ezra's not really hearing them so much. Ezra really wants to hear. He has a very direct, simple question, which is, how do we fight the Inquisitors and Vader? And Yoda, being old, is like, I don't even think fighting is like the move, man. Like, you've already won by existing. What matters is that you don't go to their level. If you do try to fight them, then it's a toss-up of like who's going to physically survive. What matters is that the light side of the Force survives.
Hmm.
And Ezra is not reading through the Yoda speak because it's his first time dealing with it. And so...
Well, second.
Yeah. And so he's like, so what do I do? And Yoda tells him to go to Malachor.
Have we been to Malachor before?
We have talked about Malachor once and exactly once.
When?
In the D-Squad arc.
Are you kidding me?
What's his name? Meeber Gascon says, faster than a Malachor minute.
What?
And that's all we've heard about it.
Are you kidding?
We know a ton about Malachor from other works, specifically Knights of the Old Republic 2,
hmm.
Where it is a horrific Sith planet.
Okay. Well, we do know canonically from a Dave Filoni interview that the creators of Rebels are all huge Knights of the Old Republic fans. Mm-hmm. So this totally makes sense.
Yeah. It is where the mass shadow generator was deployed, which ended the Neo-Crusaders Mandalorian War like 4,000 years before this.
Holy moly.
And it completely ate a planet.
So I guess we have some context clues for why Ahsoka and Kanan both make that face when Ezra's like, yeah, Yoda told me to go to Malachor. And they're like, Malachor?
Yeah, it's a nasty place.
Yikes. Mm-hmm.
But there's more, because there's also Ahsoka's vision.
Yeah.
So Ahsoka's vision, she has two. First, her suspicions are confirmed about Anakin. And secondly, as she's leaving the temple, she pauses and looks back, and Yoda is there and waves to her, which is important for her, going back to the Honorable Ones as far as the topic of forgiveness. Because she has stepped away from being a Jedi. She has charted her own path. I don't think she's ever felt forgiveness for herself or for others. She sees Yoda, and Yoda's like way beyond this. Yoda is no longer really a Jedi, you know? He's also moved past what it means to be part of the Jedi Order or anything. He's like, we have a duty to do good. And I think the fact that Ahsoka and him perceive each other matters for that.
Yeah, I think it just validates that he no longer holds anything against her and is happy to see her. Mm-hmm. And like, you have to imagine that Ahsoka doesn't feel like any former Jedi would be happy to see her because of how she left things.
Yeah.
There is a really interesting thing here that I didn't pick up on, which is that this episode of Rebels came out before the final seasons of the Clone Wars.
Where Rex is like, she's not a Jedi. She's not a Jedi. Don't shoot her.
And yeah. Everyone is like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you were watching this Rebels episode when it came out, you wouldn't have seen, I guess, season 6 or season 7 of the Clone Wars.
At least season 7, yeah. I'm not exactly sure of the timing there. I think that there's some elements of season 6 in this because we talk about Yoda's journey, and that's something that Yoda shares with Ezra as well. Mm. He says, I was afraid. Or Yoda says to Ezra, I was afraid. And Ezra's like, how could you be afraid? And Yoda's like, yo, everyone's afraid. It's a constant battle all the time to not let your fear control you.
Mm-hmm. To not let fear bend into anger.
Exactly.
Yeah. So Ahsoka realizes who Darth Vader is, question mark?
Yes. She is now 100% sure that Anakin became Darth Vader.
Wow.
I don't think she would be comfortable sharing that information with anyone else. She wouldn't feel comfortable sharing that with Rex or Kanan or Ezra. I mean, Ezra would be like, I don't know who either of these people are, but
it would wreck Rex.
It would wreck Kanan because Kanan knows Anakin.
Oh.
Yeah.
It would be a pretty demoralizing blow for the rebellion now that I think about it.
Yes, because it's a demoralizing blow. It took it actually happening in reverse for it to be good for Kanan to recognize when the temple guardian takes off his mask and says, you are now what I once was, a knight of the Jedi Order. And then he knights him. And that reveal that the Jedi guardian now in the Grand Inquisitor now in death is once again a Jedi shows to Kanan that like, no matter how far down the dark side you go, you can still do good. And so you may as well just stay good. Like it doesn't offer you any strength.
That brings up that I wanted to poke around about the substantiality or the reality of the visions in the Jedi Temple.
Good question.
What do you think it means that the Grand Inquisitor is dead and was not only in Kanan's vision, but was also real enough to hold off the Inquisitors?
I think that in these visions, as you perceive them, you could still, injure yourself or others. You could still be injured. What happened to the Inquisitors was they walked in, they experienced a force vision that could have killed them.
So it's not like the Grand Inquisitor was really there.
The Grand Inquisitor is part of the cosmic force now, but the cosmic force and the living force are channeled through these Jedi temples. It is where they exist outside of time.
Okay, so Yoda's alive. Correct. And is part of the living force.
Correct.
Appeared as part of the living force. The Grand Inquisitor is dead, mm-hmm. appeared as part of the cosmic force. Mm-hmm. What about Darth Vader?
Darth Vader is alive and showed up. That's a real Darth Vader right there at the end.
No. In Ahsoka's vision.
Oh. No, that was a vision. That was definitely...
Who was supplying the vision?
I think Ahsoka was.
You think she was basically in a deep trance and her subconscious connected all the dots?
I think that's what happened for her.
Interesting.
I think Ezra connected with Yoda. I think Ahsoka possibly used Yoda's strength to connect with herself. And I think Kanan stepped beyond, like, Kanan did the thing he needed to do, which is, it's not about the people. It's not about the fact that the Grand Inquisitor was a Jedi Temple Guardian. What matters is that I am a Jedi Knight because I do the things Jedi Knights need to do. That's what makes me a Jedi.
I guess I felt like either Yoda or the Grand Inquisitor lifted Kanan out of his body and provided him with the validation that he needed. I thought it was powered by someone using the Force.
I think, as with all spiritual connection lessons, it's not an external thing. It's an internal realization. You have to... Sometimes you need a lot of guidance to be shown that there is a light switch, but the light switch is inside you, and you need to be the one to flip it. And so for Kanan, it was, if I try to defend Ezra, we will all lose. And that was a realization he needed to have made by the cosmic force, because that is his trial to become a Jedi Knight.
This is deep stuff.
Yeah, this episode is really impactful, right? Because Kanan got a promotion.
He really did. He got a gold star right there in the middle of his forehead.
Yeah, he is now officially a Jedi Knight.
He passed all of his trials. Not even Anakin did that.
Correct. And Ahsoka has now learned one of the most important things of her life, which is whatever task, because she still carries with her. We've seen this in her vision over and over again, that Anakin blames, in her mind, Anakin blames her for falling to the dark side. Now, in Kenobi, we talk about that because Kenobi and Anakin and Darth Vader are talking back and forth, and Kenobi has to get over that. Mm-hmm. Kenobi has to be like, my friend truly is dead, because Darth Vader says, Anakin is dead. I killed him.
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting meditation on the burdens of love, where we love people and take their failures upon ourselves. But the reality is that you can't make anyone do anything you want them to do.
Yeah.
We are all in charge of our own destinies, and people can influence us, but no one can make us do things.
This is why Anakin's narcissism is so deadly, not because he became Darth Vader and killed all those millions of people, but because to his friends, they blame themselves for his fall when he did it for himself because he wasn't brave enough.
And we see now that it is possible to resist the call of the dark side. Kanan just did it.
Because Kanan was in a state of recognizing that fighting is the wrong answer for this, because it's the wrong way to define the problem. And that is what Yoda is trying to teach Ezra. Ezra's not ready to learn the lesson yet.
Ezra's a lot younger.
Ezra's desperate. Ezra's trying to do the right thing. Ezra's got really, he's growing very much in power, and he's got lessons to learn, but he's a long way from being a Jedi Knight. He's nowhere near the level of equanimity that Kanan has.
That's okay. Ezra has had very different object lessons in his life. I would argue that people are telling Ezra of the ways to be a Jedi, but not providing the context for it to make sense. Mm-hmm. I'm once again harping on Ezra's curriculum. I recognize this.
It's fundamentally one of the toughest problems of ever talking to someone when you're trying to teach them is you can say a very simple sentence, which is the lesson as you learned it, and it doesn't make sense until that person actually learns it for themselves. Mm-hmm. That's wisdom, is having a whole bunch of those things. And then you can spit them out like little, you know, quotable cross point needle stitches all over. And people are like, oh yeah, live, laugh, love. That's really meaningful. It's like, no, I learned that. I earned that. Uh-huh. Like, I earned live, laugh, love. I went to every temple on every continent to learn that. I got into sword fights with monsters. And until you experience that own internal realization, it's somewhat meaningless to you.
Yeah, that's why experience is so important. And yeah. Ezra is inexperienced. So this is fine. He's at the right spot for where he is. He is where he is.
And that's why Rex is a Jedi Master. Because his like very first line in the Clone Wars movie is, in my experience, or in my book, experience trumps everything.
Thank you for that little pearl, Rex. Thanks for your service on this day. All right, we got to talk about our fave.
All right, let's do some Baywatch.
Baywatch.
All right, who is your bae for this episode?
My bae is one Garazeb Aurelios.
Good, excellent. I think this is like his first or second time on there.
He will now, I think, have three or four votes.
Okay, nice.
Zeb is so eminently lovable.
Yeah.
In the honorable ones, he's warm. I mean, like, he protect, he attack, he brings snack and bandages.
Yeah.
I think the act of him giving the meteorite to Kallus is such a beautiful visual representation of what the rebellion is all about. Mm-hmm. The rebellion is trying to bring individualized light and warmth to the galaxy one person at a time.
Yeah.
Even if you are a propagandized Imperial. Mm-hmm. And I think Zeb is showing such character growth from Legends of the Lasat to now. And I think he did not have to behave with such honor and warmth, but he did. He is lovable mm-hmm. in that way.
Yeah.
And like, no wonder Kallus's icy exterior melted in the face of the sun that is Garazeb.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
It's totally Zeb. I loved it so much.
It's a very fun episode. It's great as out of all the times this particular like type of story, this enemies to friends because they need to save each other story is told. This is one of the best examples of it. It's very fun. It's a nice, tight episode. It does so much exposition for who Kallus is and who Zeb has become. I love it.
Yeah. And if you are not attached to seeing things as relentlessly straight, I think it's a nice example of queering Star Wars.
Yeah.
No, I say that with a straight face. No,
yeah, I agree. It could be. I like to leave that open.
Sure.
Yeah.
I shall close it in my mind. Case closed. This is queer.
Case closed. All right.
Who is your bae?
I'm going to go with Kanan. Kanan, there's a previous time that they enter this temple on Lothal, and in that one, Kanan sits down next to a mummified Jedi Master and says, now I'm waiting for my Padawan. And he has to deal with some pretty scary stuff, but Ezra is the one who has to do all the scary stuff. This time, Kanan is like, new problem, new door. We'll get all the Force users we know together. We're going to go do Force stuff. Mm-hmm. We're going to figure something out. And he learns the lesson and he experiences one of the most profound moments of his life, which is that there will be an end to his teaching of Ezra. Mm. At first, it was like is it the right thing for him to be teaching Ezra at all? And now he realizes, no matter how much I do, there will be a point where Ezra surpasses me. Mm. We talk about this in the Patreon, in the Elder episode of Vision Season 1, where a Jedi Knight is on his waning, suddenly he's like middle-aged and he's on his waning years, and his Padawan is on the upswing. And so this aging out is something that Kanan is like, I am now in my prime. I'm going to teach, and there will be an end to that. And that level of detachment, I think, is really valuable for him.
I also really loved that Kanan, Ahsoka, and Ezra walk into a Jedi temple. Mm-hmm. But sounds like a punchline. And Kanan is ready. He is the first one to be immediately transported into his Force vision. Because mm-hmm. he walked in and he's like, I buckled my shoes. I tightened my belt. I am ready for the lesson. And it takes Ezra and Ahsoka a lot longer to enter into their respective trances.
It does.
Kanan was ready,
and it took a little bit of doing, but eventually he's like, yep, insurmountable odds. I recognize that the fighting is the problem. I think that's really important for his character growth. I think it's admirable that they go in and they say, we need to do something about these Inquisitors and Vader. And what do they get out of it? Ahsoka gets knowledge. Ezra gets knowledge. Kanan becomes more than he was before. And the knowledge he gains is internal self-knowledge of where the bounds of his power lie. And I think that that's really an interesting spiritual introspective way of growing. And I think it's cool.
I did just realize that they didn't really get an answer to their question.
They have a place. They have a mission. They have a mission.
They have a mission.
More to follow.
More to come.
Uh-huh. Because we're rapidly approaching the end of season 2.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Well, Sam, mm-hmm. are we going to follow up on the mission in the next episodes, or is there something before that?
Well, that would be spoilers for me to tell, but
no.
I feel like I'm going to have a funny note at the end of this one, but we're in for a treat. We've got episodes 19 and 20, I believe, The Forgotten Droid and Mystery of Chopper Base.
Two chopper episodes.
Well, he's a forgotten droid. What is a forgotten droid? Is a droid who forgets?
I just realized that there's a phenomenal callback in The Honorable Ones that we didn't even mention, which is that the little fight between Chopper and the astromech droid is so season 1 of The Clone Wars mm-hmm. with the replacement droid arc.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. This is the answer to the replacement droid arc.
It is so funny. Chopper, they're like, Chopper, go take out that droid. And Chopper gets
goes
up on his wheelie.
Goes into sport mode.
He just bodies this R2 unit down and he starts plugging in. And then they're going back and forth. It's great.
Oh, it's so good.
Chopper's not afraid to be like, hey, I am crash hardened. I survived a Y-wing crash onto Ryloth from high orbit.
So. Cham Syndulla said so many mean things yeah. about me, and I didn't even cut off his feed.
Yeah, you would not believe how high an impact I can hit something with. I have this case hardened shell for a reason, damn it.
Well, more to come on the backstory and the mysteries of Chopper. Mm-hmm. If you would like to follow us on social media and see some behind-the-scenes stuff on what we're up to, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Twitter. We are also having a grand old time on the Patreon. We are into season 2 of Visions right now, mm-hmm. which is quite fun. Actually, we've got a really upsetting episode coming up this week, and yeah. it's a lot.
We watched one of them, and then because we watch these separately, but when we're watching Visions or whatever for the Patreon, we just watch it together.
We just post up on the couch.
And so we watched it, and then we're both just like silent for 5 minutes. Like, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to talk about anything ever again. So join us there. It's a lot of fun.
You can also support us in the best way possible by leaving us a 5-star review if you like what we're doing and dropping us a review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you are currently listening to your podcasts.
And send this episode to someone who has successfully navigated the 6 steps of turning an enemy into a lover.
Oh, man. And then tell us your love story. Inquiring minds want to know. And we'll talk to you next Tuesday. Bye.